I'm Josh Schabowski, an early career educator.
And I'm Erin Scholes, a lifelong learner and educator who taught Josh in middle school.
Listen in as my mentor and I discuss all the questions that come up as I begin my teaching career. This is From Student
to Teacher, a podcast to help beginning teachers through their first years of teaching.
So one of the things that stands out to me, actually from right before I started my first year of teaching, I remember calling you and it kind of so many panicked questions of like, I need to figure all of this out. And the first day is like, coming up quick. And one of the things that I had asked you about was grading and needing to figure out like a way to handle grading and all of that. And so by the time this episode is being shared, it is no longer, for the most part, the beginning of the school year. We're kind of part of the ways in, but I don't think the conversation around grading has stopped. That's kind of a continuous thing that goes on through the year. It just looks different at different places. But since this is the first time we're kind of addressing grading, I would be curious, what is the point of grading, would you say?
Wow. You said you were starting with a broad question. Way to like hardball it.
Oh, absolutely.
What is the purpose of grade? No, this is such an interesting topic because I really feel that my view on it has changed a lot over my years of teaching. I think when you first asked me that question, you had questions about like, what percentage do I do for this and for that? And I gave you the advice that I used when I first started teaching. I'm like, do whatever the other teachers are doing and just start there. Yeah, worry about the change later. But if you are working on a team with other teachers, having a common grading policy is always really, really good. Or if there's in a department, following the department policy, also very good. And an easy way to start, not such a difficult conversation.
Right.
I would say, though, over the years, like the purpose is to show student understanding. And I know this is a big topic out there about what should and shouldn't be graded, and how do you reflect that and how do you communicate student learning. So a lot of us are used to traditional grades. I know I graded you using traditional grades. And a big thing coming around now, and some people have been doing it for decades. I remember back when I was teaching you and I was doing grad school, I was like, yes, standards grading. This is it. This is how we have to do it. And I was so passionate about it. But when you're only one person,
right,
and you're not the administrator, making those shifts can be really, really difficult. But it doesn't mean you can't make shifts within your own classroom to fit your philosophy. So things that I kind of changed after learning about standards grading, was that something you learned about in school, standards grading, or was it even talked about?
Not really so much in like my undergraduate experience, I wouldn't say. Yeah, okay. It's funny though, as you're talking about this, I am picturing one of the things that you used to do with us around standards. It wasn't really grading, but you had us keep track of the standards we met and how we met them, which was just a side, but.
Oh, that's not it. Like, that's amazing. I'm so proud of me. Do you remember how I did that?
You had, it was, I remember because I tried designing something like this and then I didn't end up following through the way I needed to, but it was a table and then you had the standard written out and then a space for us to write like quarter, because we used quarters where I went to school. And then you had us put like the example that showed that we had demonstrated the standard. And I don't think it was tied to a grade per se, but to your point of finding a way to adapt that philosophy to your classroom, even if that wasn't the school's policy, you were still finding a way to tie that in.
Oh, I'm so proud of me. Actually, no, I do remember that now. And I'm sure I tied it to a portfolio, which I think is such a great way to show student learning. So to actually try and answer your question, like the purpose of grades is to show student progress. And does it have to be alphabetical or numerical? No, not at all, right? We think about our younger grades, a gold star or a green star, you know. I know at some points, both teachers I had and I tried using this, doing like check, check minus, check plus, mm-hmm. just to kind of give you the, am I on the right track? Recently been looking at a lot of different rubric styles, and thinking about standards, right? Thinking about creating standards for, or rubrics for standards that could be teacher friendly, right? Because that's what we think of when we think of, I don't know, that's what I think of when I think of standards grading, is it's cumbersome. There's a lot to put in there. And so thinking about a rubric that makes it simple for teachers, what is it that we're trying to address with this standard, and is the student doing it or not? So like that idea of a 1-point rubric, like yep or nope. Like,
right.
And if you can break the standard down to those little pieces, like yep or nope, and like that's where they're at. I think, all right, I'm going to say something and then I want your response.
Oh, okay.
Societally, like kids get grades, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
So like, why do we grade? Because we're supposed to, because it's a way of communicating. I don't know.
I don't want to cut you off by any means, because I think this is a fascinating. And I was just saying to you before we start recording, this week in one of my classes, we were talking about ungrading and what that looks like. And so the conversations and thoughts around grading have been certainly very present in my mind. And yeah, the sort of expectations we have of like, this is what grades looks like, this is how they're communicated. And how do we shift, how can we shift if the expectation is this is what grades look like in this setting, in this place, and this is what we as a society think they mean? Like, this is how we view, if you're doing a numbered scale or a lettered scale, an A, this is what an A means about understanding of content or about student ability, or like, how reflective is that? But it kind of reminds me of the game Telephone almost, in that as we are using these systems to communicate, are we really communicating clearly, or is the message getting jumbled up somehow? And to your point, if grading is all about communicating, what needs to happen so that we can be clear on this communication, so we can all be on the same page and really supporting the learners and where they need to be? And is that through the traditional grading that has been used? Is that through standards grading? Is it through other forms that we're still focused on? I mean, like I said, I have plenty of thoughts about grading, but I have fewer years of experience, and so I really haven't had as much time to try things out and kind of learn from that. So I kind of want to, do you mind if we kind of dive in and jump back for a second?
Go for it. Yeah.
You mentioned trying different ways of like the check plus, you mentioned gold stars, although that is used differently across different levels. Obviously there's numeric. What do you find to be valuable for that clear communication, like to the learner, but also to their adults? Like what has really worked for you in that?
So it's really funny. We talked about in our introductory episode that my like last year in the classroom was that hybrid year.
Yep.
So here we are, we're hybrid. We still have to give quizzes. We still have to grade quizzes. And there was this digital program that I absolutely love, and it's called Class Kick. And there's certain parts that are free, like just like any technology. You know how I am about my technology. I want to use it. I want it to be easy. I want it to be free. Find the way to use it free. One of the really cool things, okay, so the idea of Class Kick is it's a digital classroom board, but each child can have has their own. And then as a teacher, you see all of the children working. So that's how I ended up doing my quizzes. So it wasn't like you only took your quiz when you were in the classroom. Everybody took the quiz the same day, and I watched you work online. And what was really great is that I could jump into their quiz at any point and comment and talk to them. So they could message me and they could say, I don't understand what this question is asking. And then I could type them a response back, or, you know, any question they had, I could answer it. And it was one of those things that if I hadn't left the classroom the next year, I would have still used it, because it reduced that fear, I guess you will, of a student coming up to ask you a question. Nobody knew who was asking me questions and who wasn't. So I found that year that I had way more questions and way more pointed questions, right? That they were truly thinking about the work and asking those questions. I was like, why have I never had questions like this before? Because they didn't have the safety of asking it. But I think the other thing that I really loved, and if this is something you can incorporate on a hand piece of paper, like not a problem, but you could create stickers, okay? And it wasn't like, yay, good job. Like, yes, it could be. But you could literally make the sticker say whatever you wanted. So I would take those common misconceptions or those common mistakes that would happen in a quiz, and I would make a sticker for them. So I didn't have to type it 72 times. Not that, you know, all 72 students made the same mistake, but so I could just, boom, put that sticker on. And it made it so easy to provide feedback. And I think when we talk about grades, that's what we need to talk about, is it's not just how well the student did, but what's the feedback you can provide them. I worked this past year with one of my mentees at school, and her focus was feedback. And she wanted it to be quick. She wanted it to be easy. And so she did the same thing, right? She went through math problems in the unit they were doing, found the common misconceptions, you know, not aligning the decimal point, arithmetic error, or, you know, and she created on her front board a color-coded misconception board. So, and you could do this with anything. You could do this with highlighters. You could do this with sticky notes. You could do this with, you know, I always loved these, the little teddy bear counters, right? Like, oh my gosh, Josh, he just gave me a look, you guys. He doesn't know what teddy bear counters are.
Hold on.
Teddy bear.
Before you completely destroy me here, are these the little, like, I don't know, like, in, they're an inch tall, they're like primary colors?
Yes.
Okay.
In like kindergarten.
All right, I think I've redeemed it.
Why would a ninth grade teacher need teddy bear counters? Everybody needs teddy bear counters. And so why not, boom, you put it on the desk and there's your, I'm not an English teacher, but right, your structure of a sentence, and the green is the adjective, and they put it on their desk so they need to go check their adjective or whatever it is.
Right.
And so having those quick ways to provide that feedback is really what's needed in a classroom for kids to learn, right? Which is ultimately the objective. Everyone should get A's. No.
It's so funny. Several things come to mind as you're talking about the one, the A's. I just watched a TED talk recently, and it's Degrading Education by, and I so apologize if I mispronounce the name, Elizabeth Wisner Gross. As someone with a last name that often is mispronounced, I apologize sincerely. But she tells a story of, like, a lot of her students earning A's and that not being received really positively by the department chair, and sort of a difference of how we're viewing the A's in her example. But we do want to see the students demonstrate that growth in whatever we're focused on. And feedback is another part that you mentioned that I want to kind of circle back to, because it is so connected with this conversation we're having about grading, and perhaps it is really important for us to maybe keep at the center. The Association for Middle Level Education's annual conference, with a lot of the different workshops that they had, and Rick Romelli was there, and this is the first time that I think I'd ever heard of him, but I was kind of like, oh, there's so many things, and like, what should I go to? And you're like, he is one of the people you should go see. And I went to one of his
presentations about grading, and feedback was his big emphasis. And it started to become mine as well. But to the, your point of like easy feedback, the format he proposed that I really, really liked was observations. Feedback is observations, and then putting it back for the learner to be like, you know, did you mean for this to happen in your writing piece, in the math, the science explanation or whatever? Or I noticed that you've not, I'm trying to think of a math example because apparently that's your first love, but I notice you haven't rounded to the nearest hundredth place. As a result, your final answer is 400 off, which isn't, that's not realistic, but like, imagine I said something with numbers that made sense. Well, now the student's being kind of presented with like, this happened, and now as a result, this has happened. And it gives them the chance to demonstrate to you, to communicate to you as an educator, how they're thinking about this and whether this is something that they had realized or hadn't realized. And that's not a moment where you're like, and you get a B, but it doesn't really have that correlation to a direct number or letter grade, but it's showing that growth, which is what we're trying to gain an understanding of, and then also find a way to communicate.
A practical application of that, right? So if a teacher's trying to measure those things within a classroom, the clipboard is classic, you know? So you have the kids' names down one side, you have the standards across the other, and boom, Josh, who's always going to be my example, Josh met this standard and I saw it, and you could even, maybe you put a date on it, or you put, this is the activity we were doing, as a way of documenting that you've met that standard. Another way, right, we think of assessments as being, oh, these are the grades, but allowing, you know, if you put your questions and you put the standards next to it, you can see which standards they're meeting and which ones they're not. Another thing is, and our math department at our school does this, they put the rubric right on the assessment. And, you know, to earn the four, it's a 4-point rubric. This is how you have to have met the standards. And so kids know right then and there. You also made me think of, you know, that student involvement, right? Setting up activities in your classroom. So it is the student discovering that they made that mistake, right? Because that's growth, that's learning. And can be seen by the teacher and documented by the teacher. And it's one of those things, if you have the students working, if the students are the ones working during the class period, then it's that teacher's role to be doing those formative assessments. And are they meeting this? Are there misconceptions? How can I break that misconception for them?
Yeah, I think, and it's nice to bring in that formative assessment piece, because I think sometimes when we think of grades, maybe we're focused more on the summative, but the way that the formatives can look kind of take these different formats. How are we translating these demonstrations into the more expected displays of grades, of growth, I should say, within an education system? Like, what does that transition look like? How do you imagine it could look like? How does it look like now? Kind of, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, and, you know, Josh brought up Rick, and there are so many experts out there who have studied this and researched this. That is not who Josh or I am or are. So just please keep that in mind. These are just practical things that have been tried in classrooms. I think sometimes we get stuck because we all have to use the digital tool to report our grades. So I think that that can get us, force us to fall into that letter grade if that's what's being done by our schools. In terms of ways to utilize that, and I'm thinking, you know, giving those kids that second chance, third chance. Yes, I'm talking about retakes and redos, and if they can show you it a final time, then they did it. It doesn't matter that they didn't do it the first time. There's ways to put that in a gradebook to show that growth. In digital gradebooks, you can have an assignment that doesn't count, right? And you can record their progress along the way. You can put in benchmark scores. You can exempt specific grades for specific students that if they showed you later on, and you can literally call them trial one, trial two, trial three, and that's fine. There's an interesting discussion, and I don't know which way I feel one way or the other. Some people are like, oh, if you can get it on your first try, it should be worth more than if it took you till your fifth try.
Interesting.
I don't know that I agree with that. That's out there too, right? I think this is not an episode where I'm going to tell you this is the way you have to do it, because there are a lot of mindsets and possibilities out there when it comes to grading. But I think if we remember that grades are a form of communication, and that digital platform is a tool for that communication. So all of those things I said, don't just go do them, right? Let families know what you're doing, because I promise you, if you put in a benchmark score that looks like a 50%, you're going to hear about it.
Mm-hmm.
And because not all, as Josh has nicely shared, not everybody jams with math, and which, Josh, we're going to change that. I really like every listener. Trust me, if you had me for math, you would love math. Josh had me for social studies, and see, he loves social studies.
That's true. So, Good point.
but explaining to families, even putting in the title ungraded, or having some sort of signal that this is not part of their final grade, is super important. And just making sure families understand what you are doing in the grade book can save you a lot of time after the fact, so you're not just answering questions. I think this is underutilized. This is for everyone out there. New teachers, go tell your mentor teachers. Utilize the comments. Utilize the lates. Utilize the missings. Utilize the exempts and the comment space to say, you know, on their first one, they got this. On their second one, they got that. It's just a great way for you to keep track of the communication and for you to share that with families. And I think, too, educators, it's important that we teach our families how to use our digital platforms, right? Not all families know that you can even click on the grade and see all the assignments. Not all families know that when you click on an assignment, you can see the details. So making sure that however you are choosing to use it to communicate, that everybody's aware of that communication.
I want to tie several of the threads you kind of brought up, because as we sort of mentioned at the start of this episode, when this is kind of being released, published, whatever we're calling it, it might be around the time when educators are at that point in the year where they're kind of looking, maybe wrapping up a marking period, or maybe preparing those, I don't want to say final grades, but you know, those regular reports that get sent out of the grades and a student's progress. And that can be an interesting time in this school year, especially as an early career educator, as you're finding your own approach to all of this, and suddenly there may be a lot more attention on the grades than had been kind of building up to it, because more people might be aware of these deadlines or expecting certain messages about learner performance in class. So I want to circle back to this idea of like extra credit or redos or things like that. I know you didn't say extra credit, but I'm throwing it in there.
Okay.
What do you think about responses to both learners who might reach out and advocate for an extra credit opportunity or an opportunity to redo something or redemonstrate their understanding? And what about adults are advocating on their learner's behalf? And responses to those, approaches to those interactions that you might have for early career educators.
What have you decided? What do you do in your classroom now?
Hold on. I thought you were going to share your insight, and then I was going to find some way to sugarcoat and make mine sound like I do these amazing things.
No, I want to hear yours first this time.
Oh, great. I mean, I am of the perspective that multiple redos, there are some times when I'm like, when I'm benchmarking, multiple redos may not be super helpful, because I kind of need to know where someone is at in the moment in that time in order to kind of gauge. But for almost every other assignment,
I don't mind those redos, those other opportunities, especially being in like social studies. There, I don't see as much of a reason to be like, this is it. And if you didn't know it now, there's no opportunity to redo, you know, knowing a date or knowing a location of a historical event. Like, I don't see that as much in social studies as being like the be all end all moment. So I'm okay with the redos. And, you know, I'll often tell learners who are saying, hey, can I redo this? Go for it and let me know when you're done. You know, and sort of putting it on them to, hey, if you want to go for it and redo it, that's fine with me. But you have to communicate and let me know when that's happened, because I am not monitoring every second to see when you've redone it or when you haven't. Because just that bookkeeping perspective is kind of what I'm addressing now, of I'm not going to assume that you've redone it. You know, I
yeah,
being in education, right, there's multiple things we're trying to keep track of. I hate to say it, but I'm not going through every student's account in whatever assessment, you know, platform and checking to see if things have been updated or not. And it's a similar thing that I'll say with adults is like, yeah, I'm absolutely okay with a redo. The student needs to communicate when it has happened. It avoids more difficult conversations because I am pretty flexible with redos. And it's not like I'm saying, this is it, there are no more redos, kind of, et cetera. But that's in line with like my perspectives in teaching. And that's not everybody's by any means. And I'm not saying that has to be everybody's, but that I think that's helped with those conversations is being able to kind of make that blanket statement that, yeah, for sure, go ahead and redo something.
Yeah. So I love that. I'm glad I asked you first because it took my thought process in a different direction. I think you're right on when it comes to management of late assignments. Late assignments were like the bane of my existence. And I apologize to new teachers who haven't had a chance to experience this on their own yet. But it just absolutely drives me crazy when I jump into grading something and then I'm missing five of them and I know I'm going to have to come back and grade this again.
Yes.
And are you grading it the same way? Are you looking for the same mistakes? When you're grading 100, you got into this rhythm of looking for those mistakes and having an understanding of why students are making those mistakes. And so it just becomes really difficult to grade the late work. But I liked what you said in terms of having a system for students to let you know. And I actually did this in my classroom. I had late slips and the students just put their name on it. They put that date, they put the assignment and they said why it was late. And if it was a physical thing, they stapled it. If it was a digital thing, all they had to do was match the name of what it was in the grade book. And for me, like you said, it made it so easy to go, okay, now I got to go over to this digital platform and check this and that. And so it did make it easier. When we're talking end of the quarter, this is where things get tough, I think. And I was trying to think, and I think for me, when I was teaching math, because of the way our math was structured, that, you know, you were learning this concept and then you were assessed on this concept, new unit.
Sure.
I really wanted students to get that work done before they were assessed on it. I emphasized in my classroom that practice is important and that homework is your practice. And so I didn't see a point in turning it in later. Would the kid learn it? Yes. But that was also my way around. The team I was working with at that time was very strict about their late policy. They wanted to do 10% off for one day late, 50% off after that.
Oh, wow.
And my thought was just get it done before the unit test. And so I was that terrible teacher that went off kilter and didn't uphold to the team policy, which is not what I'm recommending necessarily. But it is tough when your personal beliefs and classroom philosophy conflict with that of your team or your school. End of the quarter is hard because grades are final. And while, yes, you or I could go back and change the grade book, that final grade for the quarter gets recorded as is. It doesn't change. And so that becomes tricky. Now, maybe, and I say maybe someone's working in a really great school where it's not a problem and they re-update grades all the time and awesome, beautiful. If you're not, you have to stick to those deadlines. And so making, again, that communication, making that clear to families that this is the expectation. You brought up extra credit. And this one's a tough, because I know I started my career by offering extra credit. And back then, I saw in some of our notes, like, do you grade for participation? And really early on when I was teaching social studies, I'm sure if you find our classroom syllabus from that year, it says participation this much, project this much, homework that much. Every piece was a percentage and everything was graded. When I got towards the end of my classroom, you know, the last couple years, practice was 20%. And so really there was an accountability piece to it, and assessments were 80% of your grade. And that's a tough one, right? Because some kids aren't good test takers, you know, and then that's where your redos come in as well. And what I would have said towards the end of my career in the classroom, I don't want to say end of my career, I'm still rocking it over here. there's not extra. Complete what you needed to complete, redo what you need to redo to improve your knowledge of the topic is kind of what I would say now, I think.
I think that's, and now I need an adjective. That's what I need. I need one of those little teddy bears. That's what's missing from my sentence is the adjective. No, but I can appreciate that perspective on, like, why do more focus on what you've done and going back and learning from the feedback that you received on those particular assessments or learning activities or whatever it was, and demonstrate that growth here as opposed to taking on more, if I'm understanding what you're saying, that seems to be the message there.
Well, now I'm going to pretend I teach language arts though. Right? And I just, I don't know, I look at language arts as structured differently than a math classroom.
Sure.
In that, like, if we're learning persuasive writing, there's still things within that persuasive writing that I'm always practicing. Do I really need to rewrite the same persuasive piece of writing? Or could I write a new piece of persuasive writing and say, here it is. I learned from what you taught me. I learned from my mistakes. Here's my new piece of persuasive writing. But I also, part of the reason I'm not a language arts teacher is because I wouldn't read that. Like, reading takes me forever, so maybe that's not a good idea either. I don't know.
Yeah, it's tough to balance the wanting to provide those opportunities with the realities of time being finite, and that makes it difficult because our learners aren't always aware of those deadlines that are kind of established and figuring out how to navigate those, particularly when it comes to redos and assessments and keeping those in mind. I want to jump to, you talked about fidelity of grading. What are your thoughts on grading assignments based on effort, accuracy? Like, where do those values fit in when we are looking at assessments? If we're looking at assessments to be these communicators, right? That's what grades are trying to do, is communicate. What are your thoughts on those different approaches there?
So now I'm going to break the mold again.
Please do. The mold is there to be broken.
You know, you think about a worksheet, right? Boom, you completed it, check, done. Do you grade that? One of the things I love about technology is that student feedback is immediate, which is super exciting. And I'm going to talk about another one that I really love. It's called IXL. And I used it in math class. And it's a series of questions on every possible topic standard that you want, and it's just rote practice. They now offer it for all the subject areas. Well, when I first started using this, and y'all holler if this is the first time you're hearing it, because it took me a while to learn this. So when I first started using it, I was like, okay, whatever your score is in IXL, that's going to be your score in the gradebook. So that's the way I was doing it. Well, come to learn. All right, here you go, guys. Come to learn. That's not how it's meant to be used. An 80 is proficient, like, good job. And then in IXL, for anybody who hasn't used it, once you get to a 90, you have to get every question right to get to 100. And if you get one wrong, it drops you down way more than 1 point, which is incredibly frustrating to the young user and even the older user, right? Like, I've worked so hard at this and I'm losing so many points. Well, the whole point of that was that this is meant to be the challenge zone. You're being challenged on purpose. And so I was like, whoa, total mind blown. I can't believe I've been doing this to my students. I feel so bad. How am I going to use this now? So what I ended up doing, because kids would rage quit, right? Mm. Kids would say, you know, they'd work, drop down to an 85 and be like, I'm not doing it again. It's not worth my time and effort. They would also then ignore the help that was provided for that question and learn why they got it wrong, which then perpetuates the cycle, right? So I turned it into, quote unquote, a completion grade in terms of you had to get 10 correct.
Okay.
Now, teachers, you have your sneakers, right? If you know, you have kids that'll just click until they get 10 correct. Well, you'll notice, right? They got 10 correct, but got 45 wrong in the process. There's something going on. But what I noticed when I changed from, you know, the score to your assignment is to get 10 correct, the frustration levels dropped. Mm. Like, parents were less frustrated, kids were less frustrated, and kids were learning more. Because rather than quit, go to the next question, when they got one wrong, they really sat and looked at that feedback that was provided, the how do you solve this type of problem? And then that way, they were more apt to get the next set right. And so we're not going to call it completion, but goal-oriented assignments. This is your goal. And I think this brings me to like a big point that I want to make with this conversation, because I really thought of, as we're talking, you've got your middle of the road kids, you've got your kids that already knew whatever it is you're teaching, and you've got those kids that are missing so many skills that they need in order to catch up to that learning. So I think, especially if we're going to be looking at a standards-based grading, we have to think about it as growth. Okay, I'm creating like my ideal report card now, right? So boom, I'm grading the standards. Here's how they're doing on their standards. But here's also how much they've grown in this quarter. And the reason I think that that is so important is lots of reasons, actually. Thinking about kids who already knew the topic or to which learning the topic comes very easily, they aren't actually showing very much growth. So those are the kids you want to push to those challenge zones. You want to try and get to understand more deeper. More understand deeply. The topic. Yeah, more deeply. And see, I'm learning, I'm growing. And better be able to explain it and connect it to other things. And so that growth is important. I also think those kiddos that work so hard day after day, you know, and the one that always gets me is like math has become a reading test. And that, you know, the math problems are so long and complicated and wordy that the kiddo that used to be able to just solve the math is now struggling to do the math because they don't know what math they're supposed to be doing. And so taking a kid like that and showing, look, they can meet the standards of this arithmetic, and then here's their growth towards the complexity of those word problems. Or here's a kid who doesn't know their facts, you know, their math facts. Now they met this by using a calculator, right? They knew what to prep. And so those are different forms of growth and different ways to modify for students that need it. But showing that growth that, yes, they can't do this in their head, but they can do it assisted with a calculator. And again, all of that communication, I think, is really important so that the family really knows what it is that they're capable of.
In thinking about this idea of
growth and students demonstrating these different capabilities, you know, and with a calculator, without a calculator, with these wordy math problems and with these less wordy, I presume, arithmetic setups. It's been a while since I've elected to do math questions. How do we turn this back for the students to get them to notice and reflect? Maybe it's at these different, you mentioned earlier about the way the math curriculum had been set up, right? Different topics. So maybe there's natural pauses there. How can we help our learners take that moment of, gosh, it was when I just had the numbers and the equations and whatever else goes in a math problem. Okay. Yeah, that was great. I flew through that. I knew what I was doing. No problem. Now we added all these extra details and plot lines, and things did not go so well. As the educator, it might be more easy for us because we're seeing perhaps a wider range, and so it's easier to pick up on some of these patterns or details. How do we help the learners do that?
I think it's the rubric that helps, right? I'm thinking about, I know I've been using a lot of math examples, but if I'm thinking about a science example, right, and we want our students to be able to walk through the scientific process, are you able to do it step by step individually, or can you pull them all together? And what does that look like? And I think that's part of teaching, right? That's part of the growth in your classroom and the growth from through the year is kind of showing students how to do those individual pieces and having kids practice those individual pieces and then finding ways then to pull them together. And expecting students by the end of the year to be able to walk through the whole process independently. And certainly putting in supports as needed at various points. You know, I'm thinking engineering design process right now, right? Like maybe on one project, I'm assessing just one piece of it. On the next project, maybe I expect you then to do that piece on your own and I'm assessing the next part of it. Same thing could go for writing, right? I am expecting, you know, this first paragraph, I'm expecting to help you with your details, to help you with your transition words. But then on your next paragraph, you're going to need to find those with a partner. And then at the end, you're doing it all by yourself. So there's ways to scaffold that within your classroom. And I think, and then that could be part of the rubric, right? That were they able to accomplish that with student guidance? Were they able to accomplish that with peer assistance? Were they able to accomplish that on their own? That's a really simple way. And maybe it's not even just peer assistance, but with some assistance. And maybe that is the calculator. Maybe that is a multiplication table. There's ways, again, to communicate that and what the child is actually able to do on their own.
To push this a little further, end of the quarter, do reflections for students look different at this point in the year than they do at those other little moments? And what can that look like feasibly? And what is perhaps in the best interest of the class? You know, and I talk about the class, like the course, not necessarily the student. You know, like, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Class is one of those words that just can mean everything depending on how you use it in the sentence. But having the students reflecting at the end of a quarter, thoughts on what that can look like, is, again, going back to this idea that when folks are hearing this, maybe we're starting to think about wrapping things up and we're getting ready to transition into perhaps a different marking period. What can we do to help that reflective piece?
I talked a little bit about how I used ClassKick, right? And so students could then communicate their understanding digitally for me. Now, whether this was digitally or on paper, I was still stuck to a correction format for the students. So I created a template, and the students had to put which number was incorrect on their quiz, and they had to completely redo the problem, top to bottom, beginning to end, whole thing. Then they needed to identify what was the mistake that they made, and then how to do it correctly. And I know that can sound sometimes redundant, like I didn't carry the one, I have to carry the one. But that repetition helps kids remember that that's something that they need to do. When I first started these, it was kind of just that. Later on, I kind of had the kids identify what kind of mistake it was. And that came from some learning I did at a conference, I'm sure. But that helped them see, right, to answer your question, how are kids seeing it? It's they're seeing, am I always making an arithmetic error? Am I always misreading the question? Are these the same mistakes that I'm making over and over again? And so that can be helpful too. One of the things I also did, and I can't remember where I ended on this, but when I would grade their quizzes for the first time, I would highlight their error. And that was it. So just highlighting the error. And at the like at one point, I wasn't even putting grades on their first round of their quiz. Like, it was a whole process. Like, you took your quiz, you made some errors, I highlighted the errors, now you go fix the errors, now you get the grade. And because then if they could fix them, right? And again, is it 100? Do they get half credit back? Right? I think I did half credit back. And anybody can argue with me on that. I can see lots of different sides for that. And then there was always the, well, what about the kids who made no mistakes? I gave them a common mistake because finding errors is also a skill that's important. And so they had to find that error and still go through that process. So that's kind of how I did quiz corrections. And I felt that it really worked well. And it became part of the process of we take the quiz, you get a highlighted quiz back, you correct it, then you get your final grade. So that was the way I incorporated that. And with corrections, they could use any resources that they wanted. Now, answering your actual question, end of the quarter reflections, right? So if they've had these reflections along the way, you mentioned earlier that you did reflections with me, and those did change over the years. And I kind of ended, and maybe we'll put this on Instagram for folks. I ended with those soft skills, right? What are those skills that you can't necessarily evaluate, or maybe I don't even know, right? Your work ethic at home. I don't know what that looks like. But kids can reflect on that. And I think that there's real value in that for the student in terms of, they'll know if they're being honest or not, like, but taking a look at how am I doing in class? What is my goal for this class? And how can I change those habits and the way I'm doing things now to better meet my goal? Just to make it fun, I made it like stars, like you got to color in the stars for different pieces and timeliness and participation. Again, I didn't grade participation, but if you're participating in class, if you're working with your group, you're going to be getting more out of the class than if you're not. And so by having the kids fill out their own stars, right, how are their own ratings first, and then have them set their goal, that then helps them reflect on what it is I can change and improve on to make that happen. And there's a further piece with this, right? End of first quarter often comes with parent conferences. And so this can be a really great thing to share at conferences beyond the grade. You know, and beyond, and it makes it easy too to answer that question, what can my child do to do better in your class, right? And here, this is exactly what they're planning on doing. How can you at home support that?
You kind of mentioned that the students will know if they're being honest or not with these reflections. And if we're bringing these to a conference with maybe a reflection that doesn't parallel what the educator is seeing from that student, where do you go from there?
Yeah, I would have had a conversation with the kids, you know, as they're doing this, what are you doing as a teacher? You're walking around the room, you're commenting, you're, oh, wow, you said 5 stars for turning all your practices in on time. That is not what I noticed, you know, and so there are some that you have feedback on and, you know, calling them out, they'll change it. Or, and if they're adamant, like, oh, it wasn't my fault, it was, you know, whatever it is, you can still comment on that in a parent conference and say, you know, Josh said, feels that he's always turned his assignments in on time. Here's, and this is something that I would have kept track of and probably something I would show Josh as he's filling this out. Do you notice all the lates in the gradebook? Like, so thing, again, having that evidence and that communication is super, super helpful because it will be obvious to others. In terms of, you know, participation, which is like that, it's, you know, those soft skills that are trickier or group work or things like that. You can say something like, you know, I'm so glad that Josh, you know, put a 4. I know he's been working with a group that he's really close with. We are going to be moving seats. So I know this might be a challenge for him moving forward. You know, things like that. Because you do know your students in terms of soft skills. But I think it's more important for a student to rate themselves and then have a conversation about it versus you just saying this is where you're at.
Yeah, I mean, I think some of the questions that I'm asking here are truly rooted in, yeah, I've given surveys and had the learners fill them out. And the figuring out the way to, like, oh, what I'm seeing is not exactly in line with what you're seeing, sort of like trying to navigate those conversations can be definitely something that I need to find a way to do. I mean, like you said, you'd certainly want to have those to provide that feedback in that moment and hopefully to encourage redirection. And I think there are certainly some students, some learners who do have that recognition, perhaps a little more than others. And it's interesting to think about the reasons for that. And even the motivation. So how do you present these reflections? Do you tell them that they might be shared with their adults? Do you not say that at all? Like, how is, like, because I think all of those can impact how a student reflects too. And maybe it shouldn't, but if I know that so-and-so is going to see this reflection, I may have a more optimistic outlook. I might be a little less likely to change a response to something that isn't as positive because I know what the end result is going to be. So I don't know. I do struggle with reflections from that perspective. I still haven't found out the way to roll it out with like that transparency of like, this is where it's going, but finding that way to encourage that honesty. And that's a work in progress.
Yeah. Well, and you can start with, I don't know, I'm just thinking here and thinking back to different reflection types that I did. I remember when I was doing social studies, you know, I had kids choose for their portfolio like their favorite assignment, and it doesn't matter why it's your favorite. Maybe it is your favorite because you got 100. Maybe it's your favorite because you made this really cool drawing on it, you know. But just have it, like, there's no wrong answer to that, I think, isn't okay. So just like a favorite and a least favorite, that can be, and really showing them that there's, whatever your reason is, your reason. I don't know how you would turn that into a negative one way or another for a family. It's simply just sharing what a student thinks about the content and what their work within the content. I had that sometimes. I just didn't like this topic. Totally fine. Awesome. What would be a good topic? You know, and kind of like you and I do just in discussions, it can lead to good discussion with the kid and the adult. In terms of, like, if you're having the kids rate and reflect on their work ethic in the classroom, I think you are honest that, you know, I want you to be as honest as possible. I do want to use these and share these with your families at open house, at conferences. So be as honest as possible and explain, you know. And, you know, you'll get those. I did 2.5 stars because... You know, I'm not quite this way, but I'm not quite that way. And I would say in terms of that concern, I don't want to say it's not a valid concern, but of the 100 kids in your classroom, you might have 3, and they might be the 3 that you would predict anyway. And so, and that conference is probably going a different direction anyway, you know, and there's bigger conversations to be had at a conference that for that kiddo than maybe one of your other kiddos.
Yeah, that's a good point too. Like the reflections, I don't say are optional to share, but
they don't have to be the focus point.
Correct.
It's reassuring to hear that, and hopefully for others who are looking at the reflection process and incorporating that as well, that it's one more piece of information, one more way to communicate what is going on in the student's perception too, because they are certainly involved in the process.
So Josh, as you are thinking about this school year, what is grading going to look like, do you think? And what has it looked like in the past, and what are some changes that you're thinking about making for this coming school year?
Yeah, I don't remember if I mentioned this, but this week in one of my classes is all about the ungrading. And so it's been on my mind of what I want to do and what I want grading to look like, because I haven't been happy with the way I've done it. The first year, having that conversation with you right before, I mean, I was really trying to figure it out. And, you know, I made some changes between the first year and second year, and then from the second year to the third year.
What did it look like your first year?
I mean, there were different percentages. I said I was going to have not accept late work, and then that went out the window because that requires a level of organization that I do not have at this point in my life. And so I learned from that, right? And it was like, okay, maybe that's not the most important thing for me and the most important thing for this class. Okay, that's not. And then the percentages changed the next year. And then they changed once again this past year. And I remember reaching out to you about that too, of finding a way of, based on the way the class is going, if I don't give a ton of quizzes, if I give maybe one quiz a quarter or two quizzes a quarter and the assessment block of the grade is 40%, yikes, what does that do? And again, that maybe that works for one content area, like maybe math, it does make sense to have the assessments of the project worth that much more. It didn't make sense for where I was at. So I don't have a great answer for this question, because as much as I say I've thought about grading, I also have a lot more to think about, because I do want to focus more on that feedback, and I want to find a system of grading that focuses on the feedback and not the number or the grade. But I recognize that that is not always the way that people process that information or expect to see that information. It's tough. You see lots of people doing fantastic things with grading systems, and you go, oh, I'd love to try this, and I'd love to try this, and I'd love to try this. But at the end of the day, you can't do everything all at once. You have to phase things in and out. And so I don't quite know where I'm going, which is not a great answer. But
no, that's okay.
I promise you, when we're recording this, it is not the middle of the school year, so I do have time to figure this out.
Well, and I think it's important too, like, even if it is, right? We're coming to the end of quarter one. You realized you only gave one quiz, and that one quiz is now 40% of the kids' grades. You can change it, right? It's all about that communication. So you can email to parents saying, this next quarter, we're not distinguishing between quizzes and tests and projects. It's all going to be one category. And quizzes will be weighted less than tests. And I know I'm getting into a lot of like mathy things. And I realized too, kind of talking this whole thing, that we've talked a lot about percentage grading. And I know that there's people out there that love their points grading, and points can be super simple way to, you know, this one was worth 50 points, but the quiz is only 25 points. And boom, all of a sudden your quiz is not weighted as much as your test. So that's a simple way to kind of flip that. If you need more assistance on setting up grades numerically, go see the math teachers on your teams for sure. Yeah. So, well, and I think too, it's okay to change, right? It's okay to change in the middle, and just communicate that. Communicate how you're changing it. Like last quarter, we were grading based on percentages. This quarter, we're going to shift to points. Here's how the point system is going to work. Check, done. And that's okay too. And I think, you know, I kind of started this podcast by saying, you know, we're biting off this big idea of grading. And both you and I have said throughout that we have learned things throughout our careers from different people, from books and speakers and podcasts and, talking with our colleagues that there doesn't have to be a one way fits all, one way fits your first year and your 10th year. So don't be afraid to change. Don't be afraid to find those resources from more experts than we are, and really find what fits your personal teaching philosophy. I know our school district is working really hard on this idea of standards grading and using rubrics and what that's going to look like. And some departments are way more prepared than others. And, you know, so even within the same school, some of our teachers are ready to go and some are like, Rubahoo. And, you know, and even I, as someone who's coaching the teachers and working with the teachers, I'm the one looking at what could a rubric look like. And, you know, I wrote it and I handed it to kids and they're like, I don't know what this means. And, you know, so always room for change, always room to discuss with the colleagues you work with, and find what works for you guys.
I mean, just to circle back to this idea of growth, being communicated by the grades, but also growth in how we look at the grading process and how we communicate that. Growth is certainly possible in all those different aspects from all the people involved.
Well, and I think that's a, you know, we talked about parent conferences, and I never put benchmark grades in my grade book. Like that was never, actually I did it one year and then people got really angry because they didn't understand it. And yeah, so that could be a talking point. And I know that that's something we work really hard on at my current school, is that data and showing the growth in student scores. And so finding that moment to reflect on that, and it can be really good right before the next benchmark to pull out those reflections and say, okay, this is what we said we're going to do. We're getting ready to take our benchmark. Let's get going. Looking from year to year can be a really nice way to do that, right? A lot of schools tend to use the same set of benchmark testing. And so kids can compare from year to year and watch that continuous growth. I know that teachers in my school have data walls where they track this and show the kids, and have your kids track it, right? Have your kids graph it out. Like that's a skill you're teaching, and that's the personal reflection right there, is to graph how much they're growing.
Yeah, involving them in the process of, I mean, seeing, and but also playing that out in a way that encourages them and motivates them, can be really, I don't want to say fun. Well, I guess I could say fun, depending on how you do it. I feel like fun and grades
data
don't
can
usually
be fun.
Oh, I was going to say grades and fun, but yeah, data and fun. I'm realizing I say data, you say data. Well, this is a fun realization.
Conflict.
Uh-oh.
I said data.
Yeah.
And you say data. Okay.
Yeah. All right. Moving on. But right, that expanding the process, it doesn't just have to be this one little thing that we're like, well, what does that mean? It's share it with the students, the learners, and build a process and build the classroom culture around it.
So we've had this amazing conversation about grading, about feedback, about growth. What's one thing you're going to go and take back to your own classroom and do differently?
I really like this highlighting key for mistakes and having that be such a quick feedback piece with the learners, and even maybe celebrating that as like, look, my paper looks like a rainbow. And like, okay, that's a little less scary than some sort of numerical adjustment. So I definitely will be interested in thinking more about that and looking into how that might work.
Thanks for listening to this episode of From Student to Teacher with your co-hosts, John Schabowski and Aaron Scholes.
Special thanks to our editor and producer, Scott Peasley.
The song Best Days Ahead by Jeremy Dinigan, used in this podcast, is licensed under perpetual use with the permission of the copyright owner.
You can get in contact with us through our website, www.fromstudenttoteacher.com.